We're going to be looking this evening at Psalm 18, which is on page 545. So you might like to have a copy of the Bible in front of you opened at that page. Going to try and cover the whole of the psalm in the course of the evening, which is a little challenging. Psalm 18 is, I think, the fourth longest psalm in the Bible. So there's a Trivial Pursuits question for you to be able to answer sometime. Everyone knows 119 is the longest one. Anyone know what the second and third longest is? Nope, neither do I. But Psalm 18, I think, is the fourth longest one. And in some ways, that makes it a little difficult for us to get our heads around it. It's probably a kind of like a saga. It's a song that probably someone would have sung to an audience or to a congregation rather than one that the whole congregation would have sung together, because it's simply too long for folks to have learnt off by heart and been able to sing back, and many of them wouldn't have been able to read. So it's probably, you can imagine, a singer singing to an audience, someone with the experience behind the psalm, passing on their knowledge or their experience to a group of folk gathered round them, and we'll say a little more about that later and who the singer might have been, although the title in the Good News Bible, David's Song of Victory, kind of gives it away, or does it? But we'll try and work our way through the whole of the psalm, looking at the first three verses to begin with, where it says, "How I love you, Lord. You are my defender. The Lord is my protector. He is my strong fortress. My God is my protection, and with him I am safe. He protects me like a shield. He defends me and keeps me safe. And I call to the Lord, and he saves me from my enemies. Praise the Lord." So it's very clearly a soldier's song, and any soldier needs a shield and a fortress in order to be able to fight with and fight from. Perhaps nowadays it would be a tank and a machine gun, or a tank and a radar system, or something like that. But soldiers need to have their equipment to defend themselves against their enemies. And what's happening here is this soldier is displaying his armor to us at the start of the psalm. But this warrior is a man of faith. So he says, "The Lord is my strong fortress," not some castle built of stone or shield of iron. "The Lord is my strong fortress," in verse 2, "and he protects me like a shield." And the other thing about a soldier in battle is that ideally he wants to be able to call on reinforcements, to call in the cavalry if he's fighting in the Wild West, or radio back to base for an airstrike if he's a more modern soldier. And this soldier, too, needs to call on reinforcements in verse 3. But he says, "I call on the Lord, and he saves me from my enemies." So we're coming as Christian soldiers to read this psalm, and so we need to think about who our enemies are, who are we fighting against, who stands in the way of what we believe or what we are trying to do. So think about that for a moment. And also think about what the Lord has sent us out to do, to fight for, or to crusade against. What are our marching orders as Christians? What is our Christian mission? That's really the difference between this psalm and Psalm 17 that we looked at a month ago. Psalm 17 was the song of an innocent man going about his business and preyed upon in verse 12 by evil like a lion. So that's us going about our business and we get jumped on unexpectedly. Whereas Psalm 18 is the song of a soldier, and soldiers expect to be attacked on the battlefield. So this is a soldier sent out on a mission. How do I achieve my objective? How do I deal with the enemy's attempts to frustrate what I'm trying to do or counterattack against me? So as I said, we are going to try and read through the whole of the psalm and look at it in four different sections: at rescue in verses 4 to 19, at right in verses 20 to 27, at ready in verses 28 to 42, and at rain in verses 43 to 50, and we'll sing between right and ready. So that just gives you an idea of where we're going, and then towards the end of our service we'll share the bread and wine of the Lord's Supper together. So we're starting off by thinking of rescue. And I want to start maybe just by asking you to distance yourself a wee bit from the soldier picture and think of the weather, and the worst weather that you've ever experienced, and what it's like to be out in the midst of that. So think for a moment of that experience of your own, when you've really felt at the mercy of the elements. Some of us were away hill walking yesterday, I think Neil and a few others, and we found ourselves at one stage in the top of a mountain in the teeth of a gale with some horrendous rain piling down on top of us and almost being blown off our feet. In fact, at one point Imogen was blown off her feet into my arms, which was very pleasant for me, perhaps less so for her, but quite scary for some of us, and one or two folks up there who maybe hadn't done a huge amount of hill walking before, quite disturbed by the sheer force and the violence of the weather. Have you ever been in that kind of situation? Or other times when the weather has really got hold of you? Oh, Alistair was there as well. I beg your pardon, Alistair. I do forgot. Alistair wasn't blown into my arms, I have to say. Any other times? I remember another time driving home fairly late at night in the car, and the wind was so buffeting the car that it was a real battle with the steering wheel, constantly having to drive back into the wind to avoid being blown off the road. You think of your car as a big solid thing, and all of a sudden it felt like a feather being blown about in the storms. I remember another time as a child, very young, on holiday down in Cornwall, being taken out late at night because there was a storm, and we were taken down to where the waves were crashing against the rocks. I just have this image of huge waves. Probably waves look bigger when you're, what age would I have been, 6 or 8 years old, than they do when you're an adult. But these huge waves crashing down on top of me, or not quite on top of me, but very close to where I was standing. Ever been in that kind of situation? Or maybe when the rain is just so heavy that it's thudding against you, you couldn't possibly put your umbrella up because it would just be knocked out of your hand by the weight of the water falling down. Or maybe there's other times when you've seen on TV the after effects of hillside washed away in a landslide caused by torrential rain and houses swept away with it. Or maybe a bushfire, other parts of the world, Australia or Spain, and the bushfires just raced through a whole township and there's only smoking ruins left behind. Or one time I remember on TV seeing a boat parked in the middle of the high street because the tidal wave had just picked it up and plonked it down outside McDonald's on the high street. And obviously there's a whole range of melodramatic Hollywood movies based on that kind of thing, when the weather just rips through and takes control. So it's not surprising that in ancient times folks feared the bad weather as the anger of the gods. If that kind of storm brewed up, or that kind of flood came, or the lightning struck, then folks really did fear that it was an angry God who was taking revenge on them, or a powerful God who was against them. They feared the weather. Just again, as in films sometimes, you know, whenever the baddie appears, it's always with a flash of lightning behind him, or he appears out of the storm, and everybody else shakes and quakes because the weather, bad weather, is against us, and we feel small and powerless before it. Well, all of that is reflected exactly in one little bit of the psalm that we've got in front of us. If you look from verse 7, it says, "Then the earth trembled and shook, and the foundations of the mountains rocked and quivered because God was angry, and smoke poured out of his nostrils, and a consuming flame and burning coals from his mouth. And he tore the sky apart and came down with a dark cloud under his feet. And he flew swiftly in winged creatures. He traveled on the wings of the wind." covered himself with darkness, thick clouds full of water surrounded him. Hailstones and flashes of fire came from the lightning before him and broke through the dark clouds. And then the Lord thundered from the sky, and the voice of the Most High was heard. So that's David as a man who's used to the outdoors, a shepherd boy looking after a sheep, or perhaps a soldier out in campaign, and he's seen or he remembers being a part of some of these violent storms. And he imagines that as the activity of God. God stamping, making his mark on the world, stamping his authority on it, making his presence felt. And so we ask, what has brought about this reaction? We've spoken about God's anger, because God was angry in verse 7. But what's made him angry? Well, working backwards from the verses we've just read in verse 6, it turns out that the psalmist has cried out to him, "In my trouble I called to the Lord. I called to my God for help, and in his temple he heard my voice. He listened to my cry for help." And what has made him cry out? What's he crying about? Again, if we work back, we see here is a man who has been surrounded on the battlefield and almost overwhelmed. He's staring death in the face. In verse 4, "The danger of death was all round me, and the waves of destruction rolled over me. The danger of death was round me, and the grave set its trap for me." So David is perhaps a soldier in battle, and there's these troops charging towards him, and they, he imagines, he gives them the power of nature. "The waves of destruction rolled over me." And then he calls on his God. And God looks and sees that these folks, whoever the enemy are taking advantage of the man who is praying to him. And that is what brings about this outburst of God's anger. And the thunder and the lightning and the storm crashing and the hailstones and all the rest of it to drive the enemy back. So he puts the enemy to flight in verse 14. He shot his arrows and scattered his enemies. With flashes of lightning, he sent them running. They ran for cover but were left with nowhere to hide in verse 15. Even the floor of the ocean was laid bare, and the foundations of the earth were uncovered. So it's almost as if he's imagined the enemy had been chased into the sea, and think, if we swim down to the bottom of the ocean, at least there we'll be able to hide from God. But no, blows the wind back, the wind blows the sea back, so that God can get at David's enemies. "When you rebuked your enemies, Lord, and roared at them in anger, and then having driven the enemy back," and David, who was at one a minute ago standing in the midst of the battlefield surrounded by his enemies, is now left standing alone because they are not there anymore. And then verse 16, "The Lord reached down from above and took hold of me. He pulled me out of the deep waters. He rescued me from my powerful enemies and from all those who hate me, that were too strong for me. When I was in trouble, they attacked me, but the Lord protected me. He helped me out of danger and saved me because he was pleased with me." So we've got that picture of the enemy coming in like waves crashing, about to drown David. And then the wind, the storm comes and drives the waves back. And God reaches down and plucks me out of the deep waters to that place of safety. It's a marvelous picture of God's violent, decisive, and sudden intervention on behalf of his people. And what David is doing is he is reversing our normal picture. We look at the storm, we go outside in it, or we sit inside and feel the building shake, and we're terrified. The storm is coming to get me. But David says, no, the storm is coming to get my enemies. The storm is on my side. The storm is there to protect me. Look at verse 9. "He tore the sky apart and came down with a dark cloud under his feet." It's a picture of God who has just left what he's doing. You know, if you suddenly get called in an emergency and you've got to rush out the house and you'd slam the door behind you and just go racing out, not minding what you leave in your wake. And that's the picture here. God's just torn the sky apart, hasn't got time to go and find the door, just goes crashing through the sky out of the heavens to come piling down at top speed without any delay to be with the person who's in trouble. And that's language that's reflected in Jesus' experience. It doesn't come out in the Good News Bible. If you look at Mark chapter 1 in verse 10, there's the story of Jesus' baptism. You remember what happened? Jesus came up out of the water. And in Mark chapter 1 verse 10, as soon as Jesus came up out of the water, he saw heaven opening and the Spirit coming down on him like a dove. And we think that's lovely. There's a wee gentle dove coming, floating down in a nice pastoral scene onto Jesus' shoulder. And it's all very sweet and soft and gentle. But what Mark actually says is that as soon as Jesus came up out of the water, if you've got a New International Version, you'll see this in front of you, it says that heaven was torn open. And it's that same kind of violent reaction of God. Here is Jesus up out of his baptism, about to be sent off to face the temptation that we know follows next, out into the wilderness, the wild animals there and the devil himself to tempt and try to destroy Jesus. And God says, oh, can't let him do this on his own, he's going into danger. And he tears the sky apart and comes piling down with all urgency and violence to be with Jesus so that he's not left alone for a moment. So that was Jesus at his baptism, reflecting the rescue language of Psalm 18, the soldier in danger of being overwhelmed. And it's also true in a sense of our baptism, if we understand baptism, not in the sense of a kind of formal church ceremony, but our initial encounter with God when he comes to our rescue. It's a picture of us before we are really involved in God's family or committed to him. And we're in trouble and we're needing help and we're about to be overwhelmed and the sin sickness of the world is about to sweep us away like these waves that David is facing here. But we cry out to God and he tears heaven apart. He doesn't just gently meander down or fit us into his schedule sometime in the middle of next week. He comes racing down and all the forces and all the power and all the strength at his disposal is saying to the enemies, get back. Don't you dare come anywhere near my soldier. And then as they are held back by these supernatural forces, he reaches down, plucks us out of the deep water. So that's not the end of the enemy. We'll meet the enemy again later on in the psalm. But it is the rescue. It's the enemy held back for long enough so that we can be plucked to a place of safety. So next time you're standing at the top of a mountain being lashed with hailstorms or the lightning is scaring you or the wind is shaking the building that you're in or the car that you're driving, don't think to yourself, this is really scary. Think to yourself, I'm glad I'm on God's side because I would rather have this coming to my rescue than raging against me. If I call on God, then he'll come like this, and then the fireworks will begin. So that's the first part of the psalm, and it describes the soldier going from the certainty of destruction to safety. And we then move on to this question of right. As if a new thought has occurred to the psalmist, and he wonders, why did God come to my rescue? And why is my enemy also God's enemy? Who is to choose between these soldiers on opposite sides of the battlefield, both bearing arms? When the storm comes down like this, who will be blown away and who will be left standing and rescued? And so in the next section of the psalm, from verses 20 to 27, he's really saying, what right do I have to trust that God will rescue me, to take my side in the battles? And this is what it says from verse 20. The Lord rewards me because I do what is right. He blesses me because I am innocent. I have obeyed the law of the Lord, and I have not turned away from my God. I have observed all his laws and have not disobeyed his commands. And he knows that I am faultless, that I have kept myself from doing wrong. And so he rewards me because I do what is right, because he knows that I am innocent. Lord, you are faithful to those who are faithful to you, completely good to those who are perfect. You are pure to those who are pure, but hostile to those who are wicked. You save those who are humble, but you humble those who are proud. And that's a little unsettling, is it not? Because if the storm is on the side of those whom these eight verses describe, and against the rest, then where does that leave us standing? And therefore, what we probably did, certainly my reaction when I first read these verses, and I imagine yours this evening as well, we probably thought, what an arrogant little torag this psalmist must be. How dare he say, I do what is right. I am innocent. I obey all his laws. I have not disobeyed his commands. It sounds to us like the kind of thing that the Pharisees would have said in Jesus' day before Jesus got torn into them and put them right. But what I think we need to notice if we read these verses carefully is that it's not just a description of the soldier. Okay? It's really a description of God. It is the Lord who rewards what is right. It is he who blesses the innocent. It is he who is faithful to the faithful, and good to the perfect, and pure to the pure. We obviously live in a world, and for a soldier this is something to be very much aware of, the real world where things don't always work out the way that we would want. We live in a world where the devious businessman very often gets the contract over the one who acts with integrity. Or where the insincere flatterer gets the girl instead of the one who acts with integrity. Where the rich have plenty of food to eat, and where the powerful pass laws to suit themselves. And so the singer of Psalm 73 in verse 13 is not the only one who is moved to ask, is it for nothing that I have kept myself pure? And all of us, to some extent, tend to be pragmatic about these things, don't we? We know what we should do, but sometimes we do something that will work instead. But the answer here in verses 20 to 27 is very clear, that it's not for nothing, David says, that I have kept myself pure. And that if a thundering great God will come down heavily, breathing fire and smoke on the side of innocence and right and obedience, then any sacrifices made and effort expended in that direction will not be effort expended in vain. That's what he's saying here. We can trust that God will come down on the side of right, that justice and truth will triumph, that innocence will be rewarded. And the difficulty is that we tend to see ourselves in the middle ground or in a grey area. Someone said to you, are you a good person? And you'd say, sometimes. I can think of some things I've done that are good, kind, generous, but I'm aware of the other side as well. So we would say, I'm maybe not as bad as I could be, but I'm not as good as I should be either. I try, but I sometimes fail. So we see ourselves in the middle ground or in the grey area, but here in verses 20 to 27, it's all black and white. There is the good and the bad. At the end, faithful to the faithful, good to the perfect, pure to the pure, but hostile to the wicked. There's a dividing line down the middle. Those who are on God's side and those who are his enemies. So what the psalmist is really doing here is not saying I am great and therefore I deserve God's help. He's saying God is pure. God is good. And we need to decide that it's better to be on his side than against him. So what we have here is not yet, still in the depths of the Old Testament, not yet a fully fledged doctrine of what we call substitutionary atonement in Christian theology, which is the picture of all my sin and evil transferred to Christ so that he suffers and dies as a consequence of them, and all Christ's righteousness transferred to me, so that when I appear before God in Jesus' name, God looks at me and thinks of Jesus and says, there's my perfect child. It's not yet that in Psalm 18, but it is a groping towards that. And it's not the psalmist, David, probably saying, how wonderful I am, therefore I demand to be saved. It's not David with his enemies coming towards him and saying, come on, God, you'd better come and sort this out because I deserve better than this. Because you see, the rescue comes first. And David thought his end had come. He thought he was going to end up in that grave which was ready to trap him in verse 5. And then all of a sudden the storm breaks, the enemy runs away, and he's plucked up to safety. And he's looking around and saying, what happened? How did I end up here? What possible explanation can there be for the fact that God has acted so decisively for me against my enemies? And he reflects on it, and he reflects on the character of God that is revealed by this salvation. And he thinks of a God who has sown the seeds of righteousness within us by giving us that conscience that knows what we should do, and then nurtures that through the teaching revealed in his law. See how he emphasizes obedience to God's law. Well, God has helped me to follow the pattern he wants me to live by giving me these commands. And then, ignoring my sins, he rewards what I have done right and preserves the effect of what I do well so that under him I do better. So this is a man writing saying, I aspire to the standards that God has set for me. I love the law that God has given me. And I am as disappointed with him in my failures. So it's not in the strength of my achievements or my goodness that I call to the Lord, but my faith, that faith which aligns me with him, with his standards, with his desires, with his word. And so he comes to my rescue because I am on his side in this fight against evil. In contrast, if you just jump ahead to verse 41 of the psalm, where he talks about his enemies. So in verse 3, I call to the Lord, and he saves me from my enemies. In verse 41, they cry for help, but no one saves them. They call to the Lord, but he does not answer them. So it's not enough, clearly it's not enough simply to believe that God exists, because the enemies have been destroyed. Believe that God exists. It's not enough just to believe that God is powerful, because they believe that he was strong enough to rescue them. It's not even just enough to have been humbled to that point where you've come to the end of your resources and you know that you need God's help, because they too, in verse 41, were desperate and knew it and cried to God for help, and yet God didn't come. So faith demands something else, and it demands a desire for God himself, a desire to be in a kingdom in which his word is law, and to follow the commands that he has given, and to be as pure as God himself is pure, and as innocent as God himself is perfect. I remember shortly after the first phase of the Iraq war, when the American troops had rolled into Baghdad and knocked over that statue of Saddam Hussein and cleared the Ba'ath Party out of the way, and George Bush famously said the war had been won before things went badly wrong. But I remember the TV cameras went out in the streets and did these interviews with folks, and they said, what do you think of what has happened? And the response from all was the same. They said, we're glad the Americans have come to drive Saddam Hussein out, but now we'd like them to leave, because although they hated the power that had been against them and oppressed them, they really didn't have much time for the power that had come to the rescue. And that's the guys in verse 41 here. They hated the fact that they were about to be destroyed, so they cried to God for help, but they didn't really want God to hang around after he'd helped them. They didn't have any affinity with him. They didn't have any desire to be with God. He was their escape route, but not the place they wanted to escape to. And faith is wanting to be with God. It's wanting to be away from the enemy, away from danger, out of trouble. But it's also wanting to be safe, safe in the arms of Jesus, safe in the presence of our God. So I've been rescued, but I've also been put right. I am free from my enemies, but I'm also in the company of the one who is righteous. Right, so we've got David rescued and right with God. And now he's going to be made ready. Pick up the story at verse 28, the second half of the psalm. And this is the word of God. Lord, you give me light. You dispel my darkness. You give me strength to attack my enemies and power to overcome their defenses. So at the start of the psalm, David was in the battlefield and the enemy were coming out of their fortress to attack him, and he's been rescued. But now David pictures them holed up in their fortress, and he's the one who's going on the attack, power to overcome their defenses. This God, how perfect are his deeds and how dependable his words. He is like a shield for all who seek his protection. The Lord alone is God. God alone is our defense. He is the God who makes me strong. He makes my pathway safe. He makes me sure-footed as a deer. He keeps me safe on the mountains. He trains me for battle so that I can use the strongest bow. So there's this picture of David in the mountains, but able to run around the mountains with safety. He keeps my pathway safe and makes me safe in the mountains. And how does he do that? He makes me safe by making me sure-footed as a deer. The mountain itself is still as dangerous as it ever was, but something has happened to David that makes him agile and able to escape from his enemies or hunt down his enemies, because of the nimbleness of his foot, because of the strength that has been given to him. And if you know the story of David, you know, of course, that he started his army career in Saul's army, that battle against Goliath, and he went on to fight for Saul against the Philistines over a period of time. But then there came that stage when Saul turned against him and drove him off into exile, and David did have to take refuge in the mountains and in the caves. And there's all those stories throughout the second half of 1 Samuel where David is living in like a guerrilla fighter, if you like, or a freedom fighter in the hills. And he's outnumbered by superior forces, and Saul on a number of occasions gathers huge armies to go and hunt him down, but David's able to escape because in that territory he has learned the skills, he has learned the survival techniques, he's able to disperse his men, he knows where to go, he's able to move faster than the army that is hunting him down. And although there's a series of narrow escapes, he nevertheless survives, and that goes on to the period of time prior to Saul's death, where David, again as a guerrilla fighter, is able to slip around the countryside and surprise his enemies and use the skills that he has picked up during that time in the mountains to be able to strike quickly and then retreat without any trace of his presence left. And nobody is able to track him down or take their revenge on him. And he becomes a skilled fighter. So what we have is that series of narrow escapes throughout 1 Samuel. And if you're reading it for the first time, you would be constantly saying, that's it, David's got it now. He doesn't stand a chance. He's in that situation that we read in verses 4 and 5 where the danger of death is all around him and there's no way out for him. And then a series of sudden interventions and he escapes. But what becomes apparent here is that each of these escapes was not just a way of preserving David, but also of preparing David for what comes next. He becomes a skilled and a strong soldier. In verse 34, he trains me for battle so that I can use the strongest bow. stronger the bow is, the further and faster it can fire your arrow. So if you've got a stronger bow than your enemy, then you can shoot them before you come into range for them to shoot back. So David, during this time in the mountains, is equipped for what comes next. And the result is that when David is finally called to be Israel's king, you read about it in 2 Samuel chapter 6, 5, 6, 7, David is crowned as king. And then in 2 Samuel chapter 8, as soon as he hits the throne, there's this devastating series of military victories where every enemy that has been troubling Israel for generations is suddenly swept away, because they have called to the throne a warrior king who knows how to fight battle, who is skilled and equipped in the tricks and the techniques of warfare. And so when Israel calls its refugee to the throne, this man who has been hunted and living in caves and on the run for years and years, they find that whom they have all called is a king who is ready for the battles ahead. And that's just a picture of what God does for us, that when he comes to our rescue, we reach that stage where we desire to be with God, but we know that the enemy of sin has all but overwhelmed us, and we need someone to come and lift us up out of our situation and transform it for us. We find that God doesn't just rescue us in order to preserve us, but to train us, as David is being trained here, to get us ready to serve him. And so in verse 35, O Lord, you protect me, yes. You save me, yes. But also your care has made me great. And your power has kept me safe. You have saved me from being captured, and I've never fallen. So far, so good. But what happens next? In verse 37, the tables are turned. And he goes from being the hunted to the one who can say, I pursue my enemies and catch them. And I do not stop until I destroy them. I strike them down, and they cannot rise. And they lie defeated before me. You give me strength for the battle and victory over my enemies. And you make my enemies run from me. I destroy those who hate me. And then those verses that we looked at earlier, where they cry for help but no one saves them, because the Lord is now on the side of the hunter rather than the hunted. So it's just a picture for us as Christian soldiers that says it's not just about God coming to our rescue, but it's about God recruiting us and training us and then sending us out and into the attack in a truly devastating way, so that those of us who know that we have been rescued need also to take confidence from this psalm to say there's nothing now that I cannot do, and there's no one who can stand in my way, provided of course that we remain on side with the Lord. But that sense that we are saved from weakness for greatness, from near destruction to become, well, destroyers of evil, and from those who would have prevented God's will from being done to become those who ensure that nothing stops it. And so as we move on to the last bit of the psalm in verse 43 onwards, which is about the reign of God's soldier, he says there, you saved me from a rebellious people, and now you've made me ruler over the nations, and people I did not know have now become my subjects. And foreigners bow before me. When they hear me, they obey. They lose their courage and come trembling from their fortresses. So you see how from the beginning to the end of the psalm, we've moved full circle. At the beginning of the psalm, the foreigner or the enemy was full of confidence, and David was quaking with fear and really had to fight for his life. At the end of the psalm, he doesn't even need to draw his sword, because his reputation has gone before him. And when folks hear that David is coming to town, they come trembling from their fortresses. They're not even going to try and put up any defensive opposition any longer. They know that's pointless. quaking in their boots, they come to David and say, "Don't kill me, because I'm in your hands." We don't need to speculate when it comes to this psalm about the occasion of it, because actually we know Psalm 18 is quoted more or less word for word in 2 Samuel 22. Just towards the end of the Bible story of David, we get this victory song. And so we can imagine the situation where the old established king, respected by everybody, loved by his subjects, feared by his enemies, is sitting on his throne, and perhaps his sons come up to him, or his grandsons, or maybe some of the junior officers who are being trained to take a place in the army, they come up to him and they say, "Mighty king, it's wonderful for us just to be allowed into your throne room, to be allowed to into your service. I would like to be like you. I would like one day, perhaps as one of David's sons, to sit on a throne as you sit on a throne, and to have this kind of power and authority and everything at our disposal. I would like to be," well, David was the Lion of Judah, "I would like to be the king of the jungle, the biggest of the beasts, whom everybody else fears." And David says, "Sit down and I'll sing you a song." This is how it all began. It's not always been like this. I haven't always been able to have everything done the way I want. There was a time when I thought it was all over with me and I had no resources left. And so he sings through the psalm and charts, and he says it's a process to get from where I was to where I am now. And it's the same as us, same for us as Christian soldiers. We might not have undisputed authority at the moment, but we're getting there. Sometimes we might feel like the soldier about to be swept away by the tide of the opposition. Or sometimes we might feel that we're going to have to fight hard in a battle that we should be able to win, but by golly, it's going to be a struggle. But that's part of a process which ends up in verse 43, sitting on the throne with enemies quaking before us. And you can imagine the sons or the junior soldiers looking up at the lion-like king and saying to themselves, cracking picture, isn't it? Saying to themselves, "One day I would like to look like you." And when we come right to the end of the psalm, well, there's that praise in verse 46, "The Lord lives, praise my defender, proclaim the greatness of the God who saves me. He gives me victory over my enemies, he subdues the nations under me and saves me from my foes. O Lord, you give me victory over my enemies and protect me from violent people. And so I praise you among the nations. I sing praises to you. God gives great victories to his king and shows constant love to the one he has chosen, to David and his descendants forever." And that closing verse, verse 50, "to David and his descendants forever," that, if you like, is the messianic key that unlocks the psalm for us. And allows us to say, this is not just about David's sons listening to the old established king singing a song. David and his descendants forever. Well, Jesus Christ is the son of David. And the one in whom the covenant promise made to David that one of his descendants would always be king, Jesus is the one in whom that promise is fulfilled. And so when we fall to our knees before Jesus and look up to him, and say, "You are the king, you are the one who sits upon the throne." And Jesus says, "Yes, but let me tell you a story. It wasn't always like this. There was a time when I was at my lowest ebb, and the enemies were massed against me. Pontius Pilate and all his troops, the Jews and all their religious authorities, and the grave was open for me like a trap, and the danger of death surrounded me. But God breathed fire. The stormy God came to my rescue and plucked me out of the grave, did he not? And set me on high. And even after that, there was still a battle to fight. A battle to fight for every soul that has ever been won in every part of God's kingdom and the will of God to be done in dark and dangerous places. But that battle is part of the process. that ends up with me as the acknowledged and undisputed king. And one day every knee will bow and every tongue of those who used to be my sworn enemies and arrogant as they came to arms against me, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So we might not be at the reigning stage yet. It's a long psalm and it takes a long time to get to verse 43 and 50. We might not be at the reigning stage yet, but the point is that we're getting there. Soldiers of Christ, arise and put your armour on, strong in the strength that God supplies through his eternal Son.